Lecture 7, The Origins of the Cold War.
When we approached the Cold War, I'm always remembered of the fellow during the Depression who was looking for a job as a teacher in Tennessee in a very fundamentalist area. And he was being interviewed by the school board, and they said, "Now you want to be a science teacher here." He said, "How do you teach about whether the earth is round or flat?" And he looked at the faces of the school board members carefully and looked again. And finally he said, "I can teach it either way." And essentially what we'll try to do with the Cold War is look at different ways of approaching it. But first we ought to ask, what is it? Well, the Cold War is, I think we can define, a period of intense hostility without actual combat, without actual war. And essentially it lasts in that sense from about 1947 to about 1989, some four decades. But the height of the Cold War was also a period not only without war, but also without serious negotiations. In other words, where there was a great deal of hostility and not much being done about it. And that high Cold War, that tight Cold War, if you want, really goes from about 1947 to 1963. And that's the period I'd like to focus on. It's worth remembering that for a decade, from 1945 to 1955, there were no summit meetings at all. Now, the little Cold War, that period of hostility, the rhetorical hostility that was experienced in the 1980s, the early 1980s, was really quite different from the 1950s, from the high Cold War. And it may remind us of what the difference is. There was much more contact in the 1980s, much more negotiation, various agreements, the blocks were looser. To understand the high Cold War, the peak of the Cold War, one has to go back to the comment by George Kennan when he was ambassador in Moscow and virtually isolated in the American embassy in Moscow. Kennan's comment was that being ambassador in Moscow reminded him of being interned in Berlin during World War II, a comment that did not help him with the Russians. Now, in the terms of what caused the Cold War, the debate about the Cold War, there are really three views of who was to fault. There are the traditionalists, the revisionists, and the post-revisionists. And let's look at each of them in turn. The traditionalists, and by that I would mean some of the great statesmen in their memoirs, for example, Dean Acheson's memoirs, or books like Herbert Feiss's, they argue that the Cold War was caused by Stalin and the Soviet Union. It's as simple as that, that American diplomacy was essentially defensive, the Soviets were aggressive and expansive. If anything, the United States was slow to respond. From 1945 to 47, there was only a slow awakening. And for evidence, the traditionalists would say that the United States post-war plan was for a United Nations and collective security, which was universal, and the Soviets didn't take that very seriously. They were more interested in spheres of influence. The United States demobilized most of its troops right after World War II, whereas the Soviets left large number of troops in Eastern Europe. The United States recognized Soviet interests in the February 1945 Yalta Conference, but then Stalin didn't live up to the Yalta Conference because he failed to hold free elections in Poland. So from the point of view of the traditionalist, this Soviet difference and the Soviet expansionism was confirmed in 1946 with the refusal to move quickly out of Iran, reconfirmed by the Czechoslovak coup that brought the communists to full power in 1948, and then again in the Berlin blockade of 48-49, and finally in the North Korean invasion of South Korea in 1950. So in that view, the U.S. gradually awoke to the threat and resisted it, and that was the origins of the Cold War, a relatively straightforward story. The revisionists, which was a popular school of thought among historians in the 1960s and early 70s, say almost the opposite. The Cold War was caused by American expansionism. And at the end of World War II, The world was not really bipolar. The Soviets were much weaker. The Soviets had lost 20 million people. The Americans had had casualties of less than 400,000 in World War II. The Soviet industrial production was only half of what it had been in 1939. And the Americans had sole possession of the atomic bomb. So in that sense, according to the revisionists, Stalin's policy was basically isolationist, of turning inward rather than an expansionist policy. He told Ambassador Averell Harriman in October 1945 that he was going to concentrate his energies inward. Stalin, say the revisionist, was cautious. He tended to restrain more exuberant or risk-taking communist leaders such as Mao in China or the Greeks in the Greek Civil War. And basically, the general view was that that Stalin was focusing on things at home. Now, revisionists come in two flavors, soft revisionists and hard revisionists. The soft revisionists, by which I would categorize somebody like Gar Alperovitz, blame the change to a large extent on people, using that first image of the individual to explain the changes, and they focus heavily on Roosevelt's death and the transition to Harry Truman, a far less experienced American president when it comes to international affairs. And they would cite the first meeting between Truman and Molotov shortly after Roosevelt's death in April 1945, in which Truman gives Molotov at this meeting in the White House a real dressing down. Molotov indignantly says to Truman, "I've never been talked to like that in my life." And Truman looks at him and says, "If you live up to your agreements, it won't have to be talked to like that." And that view, that sort of this transition from Roosevelt to Truman is the critical question, is reinforced in May 1945 when there's a precipitous curtailment of lend-lease to the Soviet Union. Indeed, some ships with supplies for the Soviet Union are turned back at sea. And then in August of 1945, you have the Potsdam Conference, in which Truman mentions the atomic bomb to Stalin, expecting that this will intimidate Stalin, and basically fails to do that. But it seems to be that's, again, a very non-Rooseveltian policy. And in addition, Truman begins to reorganize the Democratic Party with fewer of the left-wing Democrats, more right-wing Democrats. Henry Wallace is fired. James Forrestal, the strongly anti-communist Catholic, becomes the Secretary of Defense. And this, according to the soft revisionists, helps to explain why the Americans started the Cold War. The hard revisionists, now there I would refer to somebody like Gabriel Coco or William Appleman Williams, argue that it's not people that make the difference. It's not image one, it's image two. It's the nature of the society. It's the nature of America as a capitalist society and the particular economy that really is the source of the Cold War. And there, what they would cite is the post-war plans to make the world, in their view, safe for capitalism. They argue that the United States was seeking global economic hegemony at the end of the war, and therefore could not tolerate large parts of the world that would have autarkic leftist governments. In that sense, the American capitalists looking at the world for the post-45 period feared a return to the 1930s, in which you had a situation where the world was tightly bound by various tariffs, and the capitalists in the United States felt that they needed markets to absorb U.S. goods. There was a fear that unemployment would go up unless Americans were able to trade broadly with the rest of the world. And according to Coco, the Americans felt that they needed to export four times the level of goods that they'd exported in 1939 if they were to avoid serious unemployment. And therefore, when you look at the Marshall Plan, you should not see something that's altruistic. You should see something where the Americans are basically trying to spread capitalism. And the Soviets see the Marshall Plan essentially as a threat to their sphere of influence in Eastern Europe. Or as William A. Williams put it, the Americans have often and always supported the open door policy because the U.S. expects to walk through it. Now, the post-revisionists, and they tend to be writers in the 70s and 80s, like Robert Tucker or John Lewis Gaddis, say, well, the traditionalists and the revisionists are both right and they're both wrong. No one is to blame. The Cold War, to that extent, was just about bound to happen. And it was inherent in the structure of post-war politics. In other words, the post-revisionists are tending to look more at the third or systemic level of analysis to explain. And they say, look, after World War II, there was no longer a balance of power in the sense of a multiple balance. You had some seven large powers in 1935. You only had two in 1945. You had bipolarity and a vacuum of power in Europe. So both the United States and the Soviet Union were bound to be sucked into that vacuum. There was no way to shift and balance on a broader scale because the other countries had been defeated or weakened in World War II. And therefore, it was bound to be a competition, and therefore it's pointless to look for blame. Now, the view that the United States was sort of faultless in looking for collective security in having these broad views misses the point that the United States benefited from the United States because it wasn't much constrained by it. And the Soviet Union, while it had a sphere of influence, it's true, it's worth noticing that the Americans also had de facto a sphere of influence in the Western Hemisphere. So the behavior may not be all that much different on that dimension, say the post-revisionists. The post-revisionists say that both of these two large countries in a bipolar situation were bound to expand. In that sense, the revisionists are wrong about the motives. The reason why the two sides were bound to expand was not economic determinism, but the search for security. And that in that search for the security, in a bipolar world, neither side can allow a vacuum to be filled by the other. And that brings them essentially eyeball to eyeball in the center of Europe. And that then leads to the onset of the Cold War. Or if you want quotes from the major players of the time, the post-revisionists would point to a comment that Stalin made to Gilas, the Yugoslav leader in 1945. Stalin said, "This war is not as in the past. Whoever occupies a territory also imposes on it his own social system as far as his army can reach." And Roosevelt said to Stalin in the fall of 1944, "In this global war, there's literally no question, political or military, in which the United States is not interested." So given this bipolar structure, the fact that both are bound to be sucked in, the spiral of hostility sets in, hard lines on one side breed hard lines on the other side. Both begin to see the other in an analogy to the 30s, to Hitlerite behavior and so forth. That increases the rigidity. And this, say the post-revisionists, is the cause of the Cold War. Now, it's hard to pin down some of the answers to this because while we have some of the American archives open on the Cold War period or the origins of the Cold War, we don't have ready access to the Soviet archives. Now, in a period of glasnost, you are beginning to get conferences between American historians and Soviet historians under the Soviet Academy of Sciences, but there's still a long way to go before we have full access to archives. So the pieces that we put together are pieced together from what we know so far. But what we can see is that Franklin Roosevelt, at the end of World War II, had a great design of sorts, which he thought would help to avoid the mistakes of the last war. His view was that if you demanded unconditional surrender, you would be able to remake Germany and Japan. You should avoid the economic protectionism of the 1930s and the beggar thy neighbor policies which had contracted the world economy. You should also avoid U.S. isolationism, the mistakes that the United States got into in the 20s of pulling back from the balance of power in the world. And you should strengthen the collective security system by looking in the United Nations to have what he called the Committee of the Four Policemen, essentially the great powers in the Security Council, instead of just the weaker format of the League of Nations. And the tactics that he would use would be to maintain bipartisan domestic consensus on this approach at home, and to reassure Stalin abroad that the United States would be aware and sensitive to Stalin's security needs. Now, is that naive or not? Roosevelt is often accused of naivete in terms of his approach to the post-Cold War world. Well, I would say that it wasn't naive in design, though it was often naive in the tactics that were used. It placed too much emphasis on the UN, and it probably overestimated the dangers of U.S. isolationism, and it probably underestimated the nature of Stalin. Roosevelt turned to Stalin as a fellow political leader, often an analogy to the way that he would have won over a political leader in the United States. And I think that was often a misestimate. As William Taubman has described Roosevelt's behavior, he says, the president acted as if genuine cooperation, as the Americans understood the term, were possible both during and after the war. Roosevelt apparently had forgotten, if indeed he ever knew, that in Stalin's eyes he was not all that different from Hitler, both of them being heads of powerful capitalist states whose long-term ambitions clashed with those of the Kremlin. To FDR, Stalin was Uncle Joe, UJ for short. A crude but accurate way of putting it is that Roosevelt did not realize that Stalin and his men were ultimately bastards. Bastard being defined in this context is one who, in the name of the people, murders millions of them, who, to defend against Hitler, signed a hit pact with him, divides the spoils of war with him, and like him expels, exterminates, or enslaves neighboring peoples, who stands aside and fulminates against the democracies as Germany moves west, and then blames them for not helping enough when Hitler moves east. So that's an indictment of Roosevelt's view of Stalin. But the myth of Roosevelt selling out the United States at the end of World War II, and that being the cause of the Cold War, is wrong. Roosevelt actually did several shrewd things. He delayed starting up a second front for 2 years. He tried to tie Reconstruction aid to political concessions from Stalin. He rejected the idea of sharing A-bomb secrets without any quid pro quo. And he was quite realistic about who would have troops in Eastern Europe. It's worth remembering that the Soviets were able to impose their system because that's where they were, going back to Stalin's comment to Gillas. His mistake, I think, was to think that Stalin saw the world his way and understood his domestic needs, and to think that his American-style political skills and the use of ambiguity would blur some of the real differences. So I think that's a picture of Roosevelt in this period. What about Stalin? What were his post-war plans? Well, Stalin was faced with a difficult situation at home after World War II. There had been enormous damage from the war, but even more important, he had almost lost the whole Soviet system during World War II. A number of the other nationalities in the Soviet Union had collaborated with the Germans, and there was a during that period, Stalin had had to stimulate Russian nationalism to develop some of the patriotism that he needed to mobilize the population to defeat the Germans. Thus, as he wanted to go back to a more communist regime, he had to diminish this appeal to nationalism, and he needed to tighten domestic control. Thus, his isolationism, as some put it in the revisionist camp, was that he needed to tighten things at home. And there was some value in his eyes to having the U.S. as an objective enemy. But I don't think it's true that Stalin planned or wanted the Cold War, or a hot one either, in the terms that it's sometimes put. Stalin preferred to allow some cooperation to occur. This would allow him to pursue his goals in Eastern Europe, would allow him to get some loans from the United States, and he thought that the capitalist system, because of its inevitable crises, would need to lend capital to him. And in 10 or 15 years, he felt that the crisis of capitalism would come true, as his Marxist ideology taught him, and he would then be well restored and ready to benefit from that situation. In terms of his foreign policy objectives, Stalin at the end of the war wanted to, first of all, protect the Stalinist system at home, And that always meant there had to be some limits on cooperation. You couldn't have too much penetration of Western democracies into the Soviet system. He also wanted to maintain the gains of the 1939 pact that he'd signed in Hitler. He didn't want to have to give back the Baltics or parts of Poland or the positions that he had won from that. And he felt also that it was a good idea to probe soft spots, that when there were opportunities for pursuing Soviet interests, that that was a sensible thing to pursue, but not necessarily at high levels of risk. As Stalin had told Anthony Eden in 1941, he always preferred math to algebra, simple practical things. And therefore, when you look at the post-war record and you see that Stalin was cautious in China or in Czechoslovakia or in Finland, this fits with the picture of Stalin as the long-run calculator rather than the high risk-taker such as Hitler had been. Now, what actually happened in the Cold War? I think in terms of the tight Cold War, the period from 47 to 63, you can divide it into four phases. From 45 to 47, you have a period of a gradual onset of the Cold War. From 47 to 49, you have the period you might call the declaration of Cold War. From 50 to 55, you have the most rigid period of Cold War. And from 55 to 62, you have Khrushchev's globalism and the beginnings of a détente, or beginnings of a relaxation of the tensions that eventually increase over time. The first phase, I think it's true to say that neither Stalin nor Hitler, nor Truman were looking for Cold War. Molotov and Truman, that famous meeting where Truman chews out Molotov, was really tactical. Truman follows that up by sending Harry Hopkins, Roosevelt's trusted advisor, to Moscow to find out what's going on. Indeed, even after the Potsdam Conference, Truman still tends to see Stalin as a moderate. Again, taking Taubman's version of Truman's view in that period, it goes as follows. Truman's hard line coexisted with a softer one, which was often the same interpretation Roosevelt's had been, and to the sort of manipulation that Stalin had tried on FDR. The Soviets might be barbarians, but as Truman still managed to picture them in American terms. As late as 1949, with supposedly all illusions gone and the Cold War raging in earnest, Truman told friend and biographer Jonathan Daniels, "I like Stalin. Stalin is near like Tom Pendergrass, the former Democratic boss of Missouri, as any man I know." So this view that Truman sort of was scheming or plotting Cold War, it strikes me, is not consistent with the way he behaved from 45 to 47, where he was really still trying to rescue elements of the Roosevelt design. In fact, in 1946, when George Kennan sent his long cable from Moscow warning against the soft American policy, the worry was that the Americans weren't facing up adequately to the Stalin's designs. The period also is the period in which Winston Churchill, visiting the United States, tries to wake up the Americans with his famous Iron Curtain speech in March of 46. And Stalin follows with a tough speech of his own. But even during this period, Secretary of State Burns still continues negotiating with the Soviets, looking for a post-war settlement. And Truman asks Clark Clifford, his assistant at the time, to try to do a report by interviewing different people in bureaucracy to tell him what's the real situation of how we should deal with the Soviets. Clifford comes back with a report saying it looks like the Soviets are really expansionist and that we should be taking a tougher line. What does Truman do with Clifford's report? He locks it up. He's not ready to go this far yet. So in that sense, it's not until 1947 that Truman changes from the basic Rooseveltian strategy. So in that first period, 45 to 47, you only have a gradual onset of the Cold War. And there are really six issues in this period that contribute to that onset. It's not Truman's personality, but six, I think, very concrete issues. One is the role of Poland in Eastern Europe. After all, in one simplistic sort of sense, this was the cause of World War II, what was going to happen to Poland. And the argument here was that it appeared as though Stalin had broken a clear commitment to have free elections in Poland after the war. The trouble is it was never that clear. When Roosevelt and Stalin had met at Tehran during the war, Roosevelt had raised the issue of Poland and its post-war status. But he had raised it in an odd way. He had said to Stalin, "I'd like to talk to you about a domestic political issue in the United States. We have the 1944 elections coming up, and I have a lot of Polish voters." Not exactly the hardest way to make a démarche. And in Yalta, in February 1945, the statements about Poland, the Declaration on Liberated Europe, was quite ambiguous. So that when Stalin came to the situation where it was his troops that were on the ground in Poland, he basically squeezed every last ounce of juice out of that ambiguous lemon and left the Americans with a feeling that they had been misled. The second issue which led to the onset of the Cold War related to economic issues and lend-lease. That precipitous turning of the ships back from their with their cargoes that were supposed to go to the Soviet Union in May of 1945 was partly because of a bureaucratic mistake. In January 45 and February 46, the Soviets requested loans from the United States, but the U.S. dragged its feet, feeling that the Soviets were not quite living up to what they expected, and the Soviets then, seeing the Americans not willing to come to their aid as Stalin had expected, you had a situation where this difference over economic assistance contributed to the onset of worse relations. A third issue was Germany. At the Yalta Conference, there had been an agreement that Germany should pay something like $20 billion in reparations, half of which were to go to the Soviet Union, or at least as a basis for negotiations. Now, at the Potsdam Conference in July of 1945, the Soviets said that they wanted their $10 billion to come from the zones of Germany that were occupied by the West, rather than from their own zones. Truman, worried about reconstruction of the areas that the West was occupying, tells the Soviets, "Take it from your own zone. If there's any surplus left over from our area, we might help you out, but take it from your own area." And that gradually leads to divisions over how to reconstruct Germany. The initial intent was not to formally divide Germany. There were merely zones for a single occupied Germany. But in the reconstruction of Germany, the western zones form a single area for a western currency, which begins the integration of western Germany. Stalin replies to this with pressure on Berlin, which leads to the Berlin crisis. And what you find then is that Germany and how to treat Germany becomes a significant cause in itself to the onset of the Cold War. A fourth cause occurs in the Far East. The Soviets join the war in the last week of the war. They rush in, seize Manchuria and four islands off the north of Japan, and Truman resists, however, their demand that now that they've joined the war, they should have a zone of occupation in Japan, as the Americans have a zone of occupation in Germany. He says, basically, you know, you only joined as a very much a latecomer. I don't see why you should have an occupation zone in Japan. We'll take care of the whole thing ourselves, thank you. There'll be no occupation zones. From the Soviet point of view, the reaction is, all right, if that's the way you want to play it, why should we share Eastern Europe with you? We've got our troops in Eastern Europe. You didn't get your troops into Eastern Europe. You got your troops in Japan. We didn't. So if you want to play it that way, as though it's a sphere of influence, that's the way it'll be. So again, that difference of view over Asia contributes to the onset. Fifth cause is the atomic bomb. I mentioned that Roosevelt had decided not to share the atomic bomb secrets with the Soviets, and Truman had dropped the bomb on Japan, basically to try to end the war, I think more than to try to intimidate the Soviets. But he did expect to have some effect on the Soviets. And in that sense, when he mentions it to Stalin at Potsdam, Stalin remains very poker-faced. Actually, Stalin had known about this through spies. And there's not much that comes out of this. there is an effort in 1946 with the Baruch plan to have a United Nations control of nuclear weaponry, which the Soviets reject at that time. Of course, they're building their own bomb, which they explode in 1949. But the last thing they want is for the United Nations, which is heavily influenced by the United States at that time, to control all nuclear weaponry when they don't yet have any of their own. And finally, sixth, there's the set of causes of the onset of the Cold War that arise in what you might call the northern tier of the Middle East. This was traditionally an area of British influence. The Soviets had moved troops into northern Iran during the war, and in March of 46, they're resistant to the idea that they should remove those troops. The U.S. supports Iran in the United Nations, and in the United Nations, the Soviets eventually move, but there's a good deal of ill will that's left over. The Soviets at the same time are putting pressure on Turkey, and in Greece there is a civil war going on between communist and non-communist Greeks, and a feeling that the Soviets are not doing enough to restrain the communists in Greece. So these six issues are real issues, though misperceptions may have exaggerated some of them. And we have to ask the question, is could appeasement have worked? Could you have held off a Cold War if we had been more forthcoming or accommodating? My answer to that is, I think probably not. And that's an answer that's consistent with Kennan's 1946 long cable. That the Stalin's approach was try to probe the soft spots, and that appeasement would have just convinced him that there were more such soft spots. In fact, Maxim Litvinov tells the Americans in June of 1946 that concessions would only produce the next series of demands because of ideological beliefs on Stalin's part that conflict is inevitable and that softness would merely confirm that this was an opportunity. On the other hand, it's possible that hard bargaining might have limited some of Stalin's advances during this period of 45 to 47. Go back to Stalin's comment to Eden about his preference for math over algebra. It's possible that taking a harder line somewhat sooner might have made him do his math calculations a bit differently. Indeed, Adam Ulam at Harvard argues that perhaps a somewhat harder position plus a clearer willingness to negotiate might have limited the type of Cold War that we got into. But in any case, in the second phase of the Cold War, what I would call the declaration of Cold War from 1947 to 49, that's not what happens, but things get even tighter. And this second phase arose with the last of the six issues that I mentioned, the question of what happens to Greece and Turkey in the face of British decline. What basically, in by 1947, the British are feeling the weakness which had occurred as a result of their being stretched in the war, and the feeling is that Britain can no longer play the role of a stabilizer in the Eastern Mediterranean. So the question then is, will the U.S. step in Britain's place? Will it provide the aid to Greece and Turkey that are necessary? This would be a considerable break with the American tradition in terms of our roles in this area. And the question is, could Truman do it? In other words, could he move in and say, yes, we will come to the support of Greece and Turkey? At this time, there was still a strong fear of isolationism. People looking backward to what happened after World War I said it's very unlikely that the Americans are going to be able to keep an extended presence overseas. Truman consults Senator Vandenberg, Republican leader in the Senate, and Vandenberg tells him, I can probably get you support for this if you're going out to support Greece and Turkey, but if so, you're going to have to scare hell out of the American people. And so Truman, when he enunciates his doctrine as to why we're coming to the support of Greece and Turkey, doesn't enunciate it in classical balance of power terms of replacing a declining Britain. He puts it in moralistic or global ideological terms, along the lines of the needs to support free people everywhere. In the Department of State, George Kennan is appalled. This is not clear, classic balance of power diplomacy. This is ideological, much too ideological, much too open-ended. It's the kinds of things that can lead you into all sorts of problems in the future. So the question is, were Truman and Acheson wrong to exaggerate like this? Well, it's hard to say. Democratic opinion may be hard to change, or harder to change than opinion in totalitarian systems. And maybe you need exaggeration to speed up changes. Or if you want a simple analogy, maybe you have to tug hard on the reins when you're trying to turn a team of unruly horses. Now, if the danger was real, then they saw the exaggeration as necessary. But that exaggeration, that ideologization of American rationale for its policy, again changed or contributed to the nature of the Cold War. In June of 47, Secretary of State Marshall gives the graduation speech at Harvard, which launches the Marshall Plan, economic aid to Europe to try to restore the European economies. The initial invitation says that the Soviets and the East Europeans can join in. But Stalin sees that as a threat. He sees this, the Americans, as using their economic power to try to dissolve his security barrier in Eastern Europe, to interfere with his sphere of influence. And he tells the Europeans and the East Europeans not to go to the conferences on the Marshall Plan. And he tightens the screws in Eastern Europe. When the Czechs seem like they may try to join or get involved with the Marshall Plan, in February 48, you have the communist takeover in Czechoslovakia. Truman reacts by seeing this in terms of echoes of the 1930s. Stalin is acting like Hitler acted. And so he advances the plans for West European currency reform, and Stalin replies with the Berlin blockade. The U.S. replies with the airlift to relieve Berlin. And in what we see is a situation where the Americans think that Stalin is trying to force us out. Somebody like Adam Ulam will argue that Stalin was inviting us to negotiate through these tactics. But the net effect was each side became more rigid. The United States began the planning for NATO. Stalin lifted the blockade in a peace offensive, but both sides essentially were further apart than they were before that. The third phase, the rigid Cold War of 1950 to 1955, starts in 1949 as a prelude with two shocks. One is the shock of the Soviet A-bomb, which the Americans hadn't realized would occur so quickly, and the other was the shock of the so-called loss of China to communism in 1949. In 1950, responding to these shocks, the National Security Council issues a document called NSC 68, which believes or says that there will probably be a Soviet attack in 4 to 5 years, because the Soviets are seeking global domination. And it calls on the Americans to increase the defense budget to something in the range of $20 to $50 billion. Truman at the time wants to limit the defense budget to about $15 billion. And it looks like, until June of 1950, as though Truman will resist this alarmist call of NSC 68 and will essentially hold the line for largely fiscal reasons. But then Korea comes, and that's a turning point, which essentially locks in the Cold War. In June of 1950, the North Koreans go into South Korea. Now, why would that be? Well, Khrushchev has told us in his memoirs that Kim Il-sung, the North Korean leader, pressed Stalin to allow him to unify the peninsula through military force. And it appeared to Stalin that there was no reason not to allow this, because the Americans, apparently, were not all that worried about Korea. The Joint Chiefs of Staff had said that this was not a high priority for us. Dean Acheson, in the early part of 1950, had said that Korea was outside our defense perimeter. So in that sense, it looked like a situation where one of your clients says, "Can I have this?" And the Americans say, "We don't care much about it." The answer is, "Why not?" Well, the trouble is, Harry Truman responded in terms of the 1930s. When he heard about the North Korean invasion of South Korea, his reaction is, "This reminds me of aggression in the 30s, and the lesson is to stand up to aggression everywhere." The major effects of that, of course, were not merely the Korean War, but essentially to confirm the suspicions of those who said that Stalin is like Hitler, it is like the 1930s. It provided more than the funds that had been demanded for the defense budget by NSC 68. It got the U.S. embroiled in war with China, and which led to non-recognition with China of China, the Chinese Communist government, for more than a decade and a half. And it led to an enormously frustrating war, which accentuated the rise of McCarthyism in terms of American domestic politics. So it led to essentially a rigid Cold War with tightness of the blocks in world politics. The fourth phase is an effort initially of Khrushchev to expand Soviet influence globally, which leads to a confrontation at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then with that, finally a drawing back from the brink and a beginnings of some degree of early détente. In 53, Stalin dies. In 55, there is an Austrian state treaty and a Geneva summit, the first summit in 10 years, an early version of some détente or efforts in that direction or a peace offensive. In 56, you have a certain amount of de-Stalinization, and you have the events in Poland and Hungary, the Soviet invasion of Hungary to keep it within the communist bloc. But in 58 to 62, you have a number of adventures in which Khrushchev is trying to get a position where essentially he can reach some larger agreement with the Americans. One of the things he does, of course, is to try to get a quick fix by putting missiles in Cuba. The missiles in Cuba are discovered. You have the closest we come in the whole post-Cold War, post-war period, to a nuclear crisis. And in those circumstances, the two sides essentially coming to the brink, staring over into the abyss and backing away. That's followed in 1963 by the first arms control agreement, the Limited Test Ban Treaty, by Kennedy's American University speech, by the beginning of wheat sales to the Soviet Union, and not the end of the Cold War, but a gradual working away from the brink, relaxation of some of the most intense tensions of the height of the Cold War. So if we look back over this period and we ask the question, was the Cold War inevitable? I think you can say that the post-revisionists were probably right that the Cold War was highly likely. The structure of the international system, this bipolarity and the vacuum between them, meant that those six issues that I mentioned were bound to arise and to have some sort of negative effects. In addition, the process of the international system was not moderate because of the ideological differences between the two major states, and therefore the UN system could not work as Franklin Roosevelt had hoped it could as a collective security system. But I think the post-revisionists rest or rely a little bit too heavily on systemic levels of explanation. It might have been inevitable or nearly inevitable, but how deep did the Cold War have to go? After all, there were different phases. And in the 70s, you had bipolarity, but you also had degrees of détente. And it's possible that alternative strategies might have helped to alleviate the depth of the Cold War. Ironically, a somewhat harder American position in 45 to 47, a somewhat more negotiations-oriented position in 47 to 55, might each have been more effective than what was actually done. In that sense, it's a little bit like Europe in the interwar period. So to understand the depth of the Cold War, one has to look at the other two levels of analysis, the personalities involved and the nature of domestic politics. And there I think the revisionists add something by saying that it's right to look at domestic politics, but I think they're wrong to focus so heavily on economic determinism. I think you have to look more at the role of exaggeration and ideology in domestic politics of a democracy, and you also have to look more on the role of Stalin as a personality in the determination of events within a totalitarian system. So in that sense, the perceptions which led to repeating of the 1950s in terms of analogies to the 1930s may have actually locked in rigidity on both sides, and that means that the historical analogies may have been somewhat too simplified. But if that's how we got into the Cold War, why didn't it become war? Why did it stay cold? In other words, we've explained the origins of the Cold War. Why wasn't I spending this time explaining the origins of World War III, other than the fact that if it had been World War III, none of us might have been here? Well, it seems to me that there are many causes for that. But to my mind, the biggest of the causes is probably nuclear weapons. I sometimes summarize this by what I call the crystal ball effect. Nuclear weapons provided a capability for destruction at the military level so out of proportion to any goal that could be achieved that it led political leaders to essentially be able to see what the end of a war might look like and compare it with what they were intending. Or another way of thinking that is, let's go back to our picture of World War I and imagine that in August of 1914, when the leaders were expecting a short, sharp war where the troops would be home by Christmas, that you had been able to hand them a crystal ball. And you said, look inside this, Tsar Nicholas. Look inside this, Kaiser Wilhelm. Tell me, do you still want war? As you look at this picture of 1918, what do you see? Your empire has been dismantled. You have lost your throne, and millions of your people have been killed. Is it still worth it? I suspect with that picture that they would have withdrawn from the brink. They would have stepped back. Now, to some extent, nuclear weapons, because of their utter horror, their possibility of devastation, give every political leader a crystal ball of what the world could look like after a major nuclear war. So to some extent, you could argue that as we've seen the run-up to the Cold War, we ask the question, why didn't it go further into war? It may be that paradoxically, nuclear weapons had something to do with it, that increasing destructiveness of war, that picture that you can see in the crystal ball, led people to draw back. The irony is that the vast destructiveness of war may have brought about that degree of moderation. It's also interesting that if you go back to one of the liberal thinkers in international politics that we cited in an early lecture, Immanuel Kant, in the 18th century, when he was speculating at how you might get beyond a phase where wars or major wars were likely, he said there may be three causes. It may have something to do with the growth of economic relations, may have something to do with the more democratic or what he called republican forms of governments between states. But another one that he cited was it may be because war will become too destructive. Be ironic, wouldn't it, if the discoveries of the scientists in terms of splitting the atom was one of the reasons why Kant's vision in the 18th century came true. We don't know, but in the next lecture we'll do some speculating about the future in a post-Cold War world.